That's what I would tell you to do. But let's start. Even though you don't have the chumash in front of you, we'll start and we'll take it from there. So what I wanted to address is what I found to be just a fascinating insight into the story of this extremely complex family dynamic of the brothers and Yosef. And the Torah drops us a lot of different hints as to what were the components of it. Yaakov shows his favoritism. He loves his son Yosef more than everybody else. But one of the more complex comments is, in the very beginning of the parasha, the Torah says, "Vayave Yosef es dibatzam ra'ah el avim," that Yosef brought evil reports about the brothers to their father. Which it has to be understood. He brought these evil reports. What did he say? What did he do? So what I wanted to share is this idea that Rashi tells us what he does, and then the Maral, he would bring evil reports about his brothers to their father, back to Yaakov. So we'll need to ask, like, what did he say? What did he say about them? And what's the meaning behind this whole? It's just a complex thing. What's made complex about it is what Rashi tells us what he did. Rashi's language, I know you don't have it in front of you, so I'll just read and translate. Rashi says as follows: Kol ra, every evil, shehaya roe be'echav, that he saw in his brothers, of the bnei Leah, that Leah had six children, and then there were four children from the maidservants. So all the evil that he saw from the six children of Leah, hayomagid la'aviv, he would tell to his father. It's a strong sentence. Every evil that he saw in the brothers, the six brothers, he would say to their father. Then Rashi gives three specific examples. Example number one, shehayu ochlin aver minachai. They would eat aver minachai. Aver minachai is where you take a piece of an animal, and you, while the animal is still alive, you cut off its hind leg or something, and then you cook up the animal, you eat up the animal, but the meat was cut off while the animal was still alive. Okay, so this is Perek Lamed Zayin Pasuk Beis. Yeah, you're right there, right at the end of that pasuk, the end of that pasuk. Exactly. Correct. That's exactly, that's the reason why, we'll see there are other reasons, just cruelty, but there at least the justification for it would be like what Shimon's saying. Agreed. We're gonna talk about that. We're gonna get to that. It is agreed. This is, you're 100% correct. This is actually one of the seven Noahide laws, meaning this was commanded to Adam, and then all through history, every human being is commanded on this prohibition. So Yosef reports to his brothers that they're doing this. I don't have to confirm nor deny that. But that's number one that he does. Then Rashi says, "Umizalzalin bivnei hashvachos," that they would degrade or denigrate the children of the maidservants, "lekroisan avadim," to call them servants. So he says, "Hey, Dad, the six sons of Leah, they're calling the other four." Remember, Yosef's number 11. There were 10 children born before him, 6 to Leah, then 4 to the maidservants, 2 each. And then finally, Yosef is born to Rachel. So Yosef says, "Hey, Dad, the big six are calling the other four, they're calling them servants. They're being mizalzel, they're degrading, they're denigrating them." That was the second thing that he reported. And the third thing Rashi says is chashudin al ha'arayos. They were suspect in the area of illicit sexual relationships. He said, "They're chashudin. I don't know, Dad, what's going on. Something's not right with the brothers in terms of their chastity. It's off. There's something bad going on." Well, that Rashi says are the three specific examples The Torah again just uses a language that he brought dibasam ra'ah, evil reports. And Rashi gives us kol ra'ah, every evil thing that he saw in the brothers, he would say. And then these three examples: they were eating Avram and Achai, they were calling them servants, the other brothers, and they were suspect in illicit relationships. Then Rashi says, and in each one of these three things, Yosef himself was punished. And then Rashi goes through, what happens when Yosef was sold? How did the brothers cover their tracks? How did they try to cover up what they did? They took his coat, and what they do with his coats? How'd they get the blood? So the Torah says, they slaughtered a goat. So Rashi says, in front of Yosef, they actually fully slaughtered the goat, and then in its blood, what's that? So Rashi not just had to prove it, but that he had to then experience everything that he said negatively about them. He had to experience in himself that he was now sold, and the way that it was covered up was through the slaughtering of an animal. And what was he sold as? A slave. He told about them that they were treating his brothers like slaves, so he was punished by turning into a slave. And then what happens to him as a slave that gets him thrown into jail? The wife of Potiphar solicits him and eventually reports on him, and he ends up in jail. So, correct. So Rashi says exactly, without using that exact language, all three of the things that he said about his brothers happened to him. He has a goat slaughtered so that its blood can be used to cover up their tracks. He's sold as a slave. He said that brothers were sold as slaves, were treating them as slaves. And then he gets involved in an illicit relationship in a way that ends up having him thrown in jail, which was for many years. Now, question that we have to address is, it's a simple question, but it's a complicated question. Was Yosef right or wrong for reporting these things? So let's ask it, let's go back even further a step. Did these things really happen or not? Did the brothers do these three things? And if they did these three things, was he wrong in reporting it? If they didn't do these three things, then he's just lying. Well, we have to figure this out because these are very different perspectives on understanding what took place. Did he make these things up? Now, that's one story. If he didn't make these things up, if they did it, was he wrong in saying, maybe that's the right... Listen, we all have a mitzvah called Tocheach, Tocheach Atam Misecha. You have to rebuke your friend. If you see somebody doing something wrong, you say something. So if you can't do something about it yourself, so say something to someone who can. So if the brothers were doing these three things, so then A, we have to understand what's going on with the brothers, but B, then he's not doing anything wrong. Then why is he punished? And if they didn't do these three things, really? Yosef is making up stories? Is that how we're supposed to understand this story here? Very complicated. So I want to share with you the Maharal's approach. There are a couple of approaches here. It's a complicated question. There's one approach which I found so powerfully insightful. I'll share it and you'll let me know what you think. Goes as follows. Here's the background. Every person has an internal clock of sorts that dictates their behavior. And one of the main components of that internal clock is their concern with getting into trouble. They want to do the right thing and not get caught doing the wrong thing. And every person has a different threshold as to how much risk they're willing to take before they get into trouble, which is based on their personal threshold of how much they care about getting into trouble. If you care less, you'll take much more risk, because it doesn't bother me so much to get in trouble. Or maybe whatever it is that I need is so great that I'm willing, even though I do care, but I'm willing to risk it because the means is such that or the ends are such, I need to do it. But there's an internal clock that's weighing your risk factor versus what you're trying to avoid doing. I'll give a very simple example that I made up, so it might not be perfect, but how fast do you drive on the highway? Right? So everybody knows there's a speed limit, and then you can go exactly the speed limit, but you're going to go faster than the speed limit. You're going to go faster than the speed limit because you have no concern about being caught. You have no concern about being dangerous, and you have no concern about being caught. Then there's a certain range above the speed limit that is where this is going to kick in, and every person will say, listen, I'm only going out to the JCC for a flag football game. It's not worth it. I'm not going to go more than 71 because this is totally not worth getting caught for this cause. I'm going to set it. I'm going to go to 65. Whenever I get there, I get there. And if I'm driving to New York and I'm cruising for 14 hours, so at different points, you'll go a little bit faster. Maybe you'll hit 80, 76, and the 70, whatever it is you do. But why do you stop at whatever speed you stop at? Why only up to there? Why aren't you going faster than that? Because at that point, it's not worth it. I'm not ready to risk that. And everyone's got a different number. It's a combination. Now, within this example, whatever you're cruising at, let's just use a number, you're cruising at 73 and you feel comfortable about that. All of a sudden someone flies by you at 77. What do you think about them? Well, you're being generous. What do you really think about them? Correct. So you can think he's a risk. I think it'd be fair. In my example, it's not crazy that you might think of him as being reckless or irresponsible. At some point, because that's beyond your comfort level, and at 100, fine. Let's put him at somewhere at like 82. In other words, 95. I think everybody would say reckless. 95 is intrinsically reckless. It's not safe, but let's say it's 80. Which you yourself have done at times and feel pretty safe doing, but only under special circumstances, it's a little reckless. Okay, but and being as may, I'm just doing, again, just for my examples, for the argument's sake, we internally choose a speed that is safe, and when we see someone violate that, it's pretty natural to see them as being reckless because they violated our, under certain times, but sometimes we do it ourselves, but certainly if it's beyond what we would do, let's say you would at 73, you'd go up to 76, and this guy's going 80, he's like, that's just reckless. He's endangering other drivers. He's not being safe. It's reckless driving. That's another example. If you're giving a lesson to your child in a subway station and there's a yellow line very brightly painted along the edge, and you give your child a lecture and you say, you see that line? That's there to keep you back. Don't go up to the edge. You technically could stand on the edge, but it's not safe. And so they painted that line to make sure that you step out. You give them a whole schmooze about it. And as soon as you finish that schmooze, some guy who doesn't hear you giving that schmooze literally walks right up to the edge, past the yellow line, sticks his head out to see if a train is coming. What are you thinking about that guy at that moment? Like, what, you're ruining this. Like, I'm trying to teach, like, safety and being a good citizen, and you are destroying that. You will not have warm, fuzzy feelings about that person or his behavior. Correct. Now, those last two examples, all of the examples, are not a perfect example of what I'm going to say, and I'm going to explain what I mean, but they're all along this line. Now, within the spiritual world, this exists as well, this concept. in the physical world we live in, we want to protect ourselves, and so we drive at a certain speed, and we stay behind the yellow line, and we only cross at certain lines. And then people who are willing to take more risks will do things that might end up being safe for them, but we, as safe citizens, don't like that you're doing it because you're taking a risk. In the spiritual world, this exists as well. A person can say, I am so concerned with not eating kosher. I'm so concerned about violating Shabbos. I will build all sorts of fences to make sure that I'm safe, because that fear, the concern of getting caught, is so great. It's like the person who already has 6 tickets and the next one he loses his license forever, he's going to drive 55. Because no risk is worth a risk. No experience of going over, I can't get a ticket. I can't deal with that. So I'm going to go 55. Correct. In other words, I'm saying, that's why no example is perfect, because the spiritual doesn't exactly parallel in this example. All right? I don't want to violate the halacha. I'm so concerned with the consequence in my spiritual life of a violation, of what that will mean to me and my neshama. I can't deal with that. So I want to make sure I get it right every time. Not only do I... Correct. An example like that. Something like that, or in terms of, or even better example would be, actually buying McDonald's coffee. Forget not just walking in. In other words, let's say a kashrus agency would say, Starbucks coffee, I mean, Starbucks isn't under our supervision, but we can assume everything there is fine. So a person might say, I'm not good with assumptions. I can't deal with that. So, If the AKC says we're the mashgiach, it's fine, I'll eat it. But if they're saying in this kind of restaurant, we have no reason to assume it's a problem, so it's fine. So most Jews will say, great, I'll buy Starbucks coffee. Right, now, but this is important. The distinction that I'm talking about is where you're buying the product that's fine. It's just that you don't know for sure. You just, AKC said, listen, it should be okay. So a Jew would be within his rights to say, I am so concerned about not doing this right. That's not enough for me. I can't eat it. I won't eat it. That would be just, that's going 50... 100%. But someone who has such a level of concern to do it right would say, I can't deal with it. I'm sorry. I don't want to deal with that. They're not required to do that, but that's what they would do out of their great concern for not ever eating something non-kosher. Okay? And that would apply in all those. It would apply in the way that one would deal with the laws of Shabbos. It would be one fence after another just because they want to be super careful. Okay, now, says the Maharal, Yosef is one of two people known as Hatzadik. Noach is referred to as a Tzadik, and Yosef is referred to as Yosef Hatzadik. That's the title. What's that? That's right. That's actually correct. I bet Noach must be somewhere in actual Tanakh as opposed to just in Chazal, but yes. What does it mean to be a tzaddik? So the Maharal says that title, to be called, and we can use that word, everybody's a tzaddik, this guy's a tzaddik, that guy's a tzaddik. What it means when Chazal, our sages, refer to someone as a tzaddik, it means this he uses the language, the moral of machmir al atzmo. He's strict on himself out of a concern lest he do something wrong. He wants to be correct. He wants to be right. He wants to be spiritually pure. And to be spiritually pure puts individual, personalized fences around things to make sure that he gets it right. He doesn't want to take a chance. Even though this behavior might be okay, I don't want to do it. I'm not ready to say that. I'm not going to say that. I will say as follows. Now, we're going to get to. He's still, at this point, what the Torah calls a nar. He's 17 years old, and he's still a lad. He's still growing up. And that's going to play a big role in this. Says the Maral. Well, let me add one point to his Maral. I once had a Rebbe who described the following scene, which is literally what this idea that we're talking about, of in one of the Musar yeshivas of Nevarduk or Slobodka in Europe, where they were always working on themselves, that the Rosh Yeshiva used to tell the boys to take on certain new behaviors, like Kabbalah, do something like this, do something now. One of the boys once took upon himself to take in Shabbos 2 hours early every week. He wasn't married, a single guy, learning in yeshiva, so usually Fridays were off. So this bochur decided he's going to shower and go to the Beis Medrash 2 hours early, take on Shabbos, and he'll learn for the 2 hours prior to Shabbos. But he made it Shabbos. He was mekabel Shabbos on himself. After 2 weeks, the Rosh Yeshiva made him stop. The Rosh Yeshiva said to him, what you're gaining in your own personal Shabbos by taking it in early, you're losing by looking at all your friends as mechalalei Shabbos. You're looking at all your friends as desecrators and violators. Because when you look out the window an hour and a half before Shabbos and they're playing ball, in your world it's Shabbos already. And you look out, all you see them, you know, turning on lights and driving and look and doing all. You're looking at them like they're doing something wrong. And you lose more than you're gaining. Exactly. 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 The challenge of taking on a personal standard above and beyond the law is seeing everybody else doing the law when you're not. So that if you create a personal internal clock to do whatever you do because this is what's right, this is the way I need to act, so it's very nice, that's what's driving your internal behavior. But you have the challenge of then going 73, and how do you view the guy going 79? You have to, well, 100% we do. That's why I found this so insightful. Correct. So I alluded to this earlier, and when I gave the shir, I had that exact same comment, and I said 100%, but guess what? The modern Orthodox do it to the Chovevei Tzion and the Chovevei Torah. They do it to the conservative do it to the reform. Everybody's in the middle lane looking. Correct. Well, that's the point here. Everybody in the middle lane looks with disdain to the cars on their left flying by, and meanwhile, the cars on their right are looking at them with the same disdain. Says the Maharal, this is unbelievable, says the Maharal, Yosef, in three primary areas where the Torah itself uses the language of Ra, wanted to build himself fences so that he shouldn't ever get caught in that. The three areas where we find the Pasuk describes Ra is the Yetzer Hara, Yetzer Lev Ha'adam Ra'at Minu Urav, a person has a terrible desire, which happened before the flood and all of the immoral destruction that brought about the flood of Noach. The Torah used, not the only time, there are three primary areas where we find in Tanakh a language of this could be Ra. a Yetzer Hara is referred to as Ra, the inclination of man. A person can have an Ayin Ra, an evil eye, not an Ayin Hara, like a red string, like a stingy eye, and a Lev Ra, having as opposed to a Lev Tov. So there's three ways to live your life, with the Yetzer Hara or a Yetzer Tov, good inclination, bad inclination. You could live your life with a Lev Tov or a Lev Ra, good or bad hearts, and a stingy or generous eye. In these three areas, Yosef, as a tzaddik, wanted to excel and created internal clocks, if you will, boundaries, in which he wouldn't go near any of those violations. The problem is, says the Maharal, from his internal world, he saw his brothers, because he built all of these personal fences, doing things which were legal but violated his personal code of conduct. And he, in his 17-year-old youth, saw them as wrong. And he goes through each one of the three examples. So that's what he goes through each example. Eiver min achai, which, as Shimon pointed out, despite it having no, you're both right, it has no justification, but the reason why it would be done would be to sustain an animal so that you could eat its meat and not have to kill the whole animal. Then what do you do with the rest of the animal? The Gemara already, even in the times of the Gemara, it was something that was done, and that people's servants were always suspect. When you had a servant who you needed to prepare your meat, you needed to watch them that they didn't do it. It was something, for whatever reason, it was done. So the example the Maharal gives is that Yosef himself would never allow his servants to prepare meat. He would always have it done himself, that he would make sure that the animal was completely slaughtered and they never had to deal with this. And he brings like a story when the brothers came to visit Yosef, for example, in Egypt, and he says specifically to his son to prepare the meat, meaning don't allow anybody else to do it. The brothers would command their servants, prepare us a meal, this is what you need to do, you need to slaughter the animal, make sure, they give them all the instructions, and might not watch every moment of what's going on. No, that's correlated to the Eiver min achai. Oh, yes, that's correlated to the Lev Ra. Because as Neil pointed out, what is the cruelest, most despicable act that you can do? You're allowed to eat meat. Good. The least you could do is kill the animal humanely and then eat its meat. You want to be a vegetarian? Very nice. You don't want to be a vegetarian? Okay. But the least you could do is not be so selfish in your desire to eat meat that you would put an animal through something like that so that you could enjoy a fresh steak. That is the cruelty of heart, the self-centeredness, so that Yosef put up all of these fences. The brothers made sure that it wasn't done. How did they make sure? They commanded all their servants to do it appropriately. But to Yosef, in his world, how could you eat meat that you weren't there at the time to make sure absolutely 100% that it wasn't done like that way? The Yetzer Hara, of course, has to do with illicit relationships. The Maharal suggests that the brothers interacted with the women of the land. They went to the store, they spoke to them, they said hello, everything was cordial and polite. But in Yosef's world, you don't speak, just like in our communities, there are different standards of how men and women are supposed to interact. When I was in yeshiva, we were told you refer to someone else's wife as Mrs. Kalnitz. You never refer to her by her first name. That's the fence that you put up. In worlds that are more to the right of the yeshiva that I went to, they didn't sit at the same table, or they sat at opposite ends of the table. I sat at Shabbos meals with friends of mine. We sat at opposite, men on one side, women on the other side. Forget about calling her by her last name. I wasn't allowed to talk to her. And in more right circles, they didn't sit at the same table. And in more left, they won't shake hands or give a kiss on the cheek. I'm in a community now where everybody gives each other a kiss on the cheek. You know, different standard every community. But whatever you're in, if you see someone doing something less than what you do, it's a violation of these relationships. So Yosef, as trying to be a... Correct. Right, exactly. He saw it as a violation, but it wasn't any violation. In his world, it was a violation of the standards he had set for himself. Exactly. Great example. Oh, it's a great example. I used to hate walking out with people driving into shul. It drives me crazy. Great example. Great, great, great example. It's hard not to see that person as violating Shabbos, because in my world it's Shabbos. I sang Kabbalah Shabbos. I'm walking home. I used to hate seeing people drive. That's a fabulous example. So that's what's going on with Yosef and all of these things. In his world, he put up in his status of being a tzaddik, but he's still a nar. He's still a child. He hasn't yet become the full Yosef HaTzaddik, and it expressed itself in reporting to his father on what. And now I have two more things after that. We're getting late. The third example was, he said that his brothers called his other brothers servants. Maral says he didn't call them servants, they just didn't treat them with a full level of respect. Now, that's a problem. But Yosef saw in that, because what's the third thing was, the evil eye, living stingy. When a person has a stingy eye, they always want to make themselves better than everybody else. They don't want to have an eye in Tova. How do you make yourself better than everybody else? So the real way is to make yourself great. The shortcut way is to make everybody else bad. Well, you feel great because in relationship to everybody else, you're better. No, and making yourself feel higher than everybody else. In other words, as long as I'm higher, then relatively speaking, I'm doing good. That's why it's a shortcut. It's a cheap shortcut. So Yosef saw in his brothers a little lack of respect that they treated the other brothers. And he saw that as calling them servants, because as if they wanted to lord themselves over the other brothers. They didn't actually call them servants. It's just that's how he perceived it in their attempt. Because he wanted to perfect this trait of living generously with a great eye. And he saw any affront to living with a stingy eye as that. So he saw the little bit of disrespect that they might have treated the brothers as they're treating them like slaves. But that was only in his world. What they did was would have been treating someone like a slave. In your world, you know, having a little bit of less respect might be like, but that's not reality. And this is all goes back to the language, says the Maral, the language Rashi used, which you don't have in front of you. Rashi said, every evil that he saw in his brothers, he reported to his father. Rashi does not say every evil that his brothers did, he reported to his father. Every evil that he saw in his brothers, he reported to his father. He saw all of these things. Because he was acting like a nar. Yeah, I mean, that's the Torah uses that language. Like there was still like an element of youth. You know, all his brothers are in their 20s and 30s, and he is a 17-year-old playing with his hair, trying to look nice, and he still had, you know, it was a personality type. however much we can address, these people on such a level. That's what the Torah wants us to learn from them, so that in the questions that we ask, like, did the brothers really do these things? Was he wrong for reporting them? If that's what he saw, he saw them. He saw these things. But in his world, he saw them. It was him taking on Shabbos 2 hours early. It was walking home from an early Shabbos and seeing somebody drive into shul, for mincha. And in his youth, not being able to distinguish that what he perceived as a person stepping over the yellow line doesn't make him a wicked person, even though you just gave a schmooze to your child about how bad it is. So that's true. They're a bad role. That is true. You're a bad role model for children in our neighborhood. To say you're a bad person is now saying, listen, intrinsically, did they cross safely? Did anything happen? They're okay. They were willing to take a risk that you're not willing to take. It gets into a fine line when we can call them a bad person. In halacha, it's much clearer. Did you violate halacha? Did you not violate halacha? So we put up certain fences. Okay, so you violated the fence, but did you violate the halacha? If you didn't violate the halacha, you're not a bad person. You didn't do anything wrong. Again, all these examples, you have to be really careful. In other words, jaywalking is actually illegal. I want the coffee Starbucks example is the best spiritual example, where the AKC said, I can't tell you 100% it's fine, but you're allowed to rely that everything is fine. It's okay. A person can say, I can't drink that. If a person says, I will drink that, then the person who doesn't cannot look at the person who does and says, that's wrong. Correct. This is an example of being a nar, and it was inappropriate to report on to his father the way Maral is learning it, what he perceived as being wrong, without the due diligence and presenting it in a way that would have allowed his father to look into it. That was inappropriate and caused his brothers to. Correct. That's right. That's right. All right, and in this example, he happens to be 17, but that behavior is an inappropriate behavior. We have an obligation, to say that it's actually fine, or maybe you need to look into it. Life is complicated. But what's not okay is to, without the due diligence, just because in your internal world, that's not something that you can do, to therefore impose that on somebody else. Now, again, the reason where this gets super complicated is that there are actual halachas that do dictate our behavior. And it's sometimes yes, sometimes no. It's a fine line where sometimes we can actually say this is an inappropriate behavior from a Jewish perspective. Sometimes that's actually true. If a person lights a match on Shabbos, it's not just in my world. That's objectively, from a Torah perspective, an inappropriate behavior. But there are many examples, like you mentioned, from one stream of Judaism to the next, in which within this one stream, that's considered inappropriate. That doesn't intrinsically, maybe in your world it's intrinsically wrong, but that doesn't mean for me it is, as long as I'm within halacha. Correct. Right, or we could say the world that you chose to send them to. So if you could say this at the Shabbos table in less than 50 minutes, they'll appreciate it. If you can say it at your Shabbos table in less than 50 minutes, they'll appreciate it. Correct. Exactly. Okay, my pleasure. This is my chumash shir before davening, and I did it. She gave the shir on Wednesday. My drush will be. I'm not sure what I'm gonna do, but this. I mean, unless I can craft this into a drush or something, we'll see. Not sure yet. All right, I hope so. All right, thanks. All the best.